it rolling, Bob?
Is it rolling, Bob?
Is it rolling, Bob?
Hi, folks, and welcome to A Head Full of Ideas, Season 3, episode number 11, I think this is. And this one's called A Price on My Soul, three songs from John Wesley Harding. And we're going to start with a quote from the Bible. This is Galatians 5, 16 to 17. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfil the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth after the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary the one to the other, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. That's the end of the sermon for today. In the wake of the motorbike crash and his withdrawal from public appearances in the mid-1960s, Bob Dylan began composing songs with more compressed poetic imagery. When John Wesley Harding first appeared at the end of 1967, it was clear that he'd taken a step back from the expansive and often delirious poetic rush of the material on Blonde on Blonde. The album was recorded in Nashville with a small backing band, mainly comprising Charlie McCoy on bass, Kenny Buttrey on drums. The understated songs were shorter, his vocals were now more subdued, and his musical presentation was minimal. A closer examination, however, can be argued that the cryptic vignettes he is now presenting are just as beguiling and ambiguous as those of his celebrated 65 to 66 period. The emphasis in these songs is clearly on the verbal games Dylan plays with us, which are foregrounded at the expense of musical colour. The songs are like Chinese puzzles. Once we open them up, they become even more mysterious. Dylan appears to be struggling with the after effects of his previously excessive lifestyle. Several songs display a distinct yearning for spiritual fulfilment, although it's arguable that Dylan himself doesn't at this point have any clear spiritual direction as such. It's been reported that in the wake of his retreat, he became very interested in studying the Bible and other religious works. On the album, he often refers to or quotes from biblical passages. In places, his tone imitates the grand style and lexicon of the King James Bible. John Bunyan's classic religious allegory, The Pilgrim's Progress, and other religious works, particularly St. Augustine of Hippo's Confessions, are other influences. The songs can be seen as parables within which Dylan wrestles with moral and existential issues. Dear Landlord is a beautifully expressive ballad, featuring a very committed and soulful vocal from Dylan, who leads the recording on piano. The narrator sings with the voice of bitter experience, apparently leaving much unsaid. We can only wonder what has brought him to this point, but it is certainly true that the tone of the song can be described as sober. Dylan's narrator begins with a striking and perhaps somewhat fearful plea. Dear Landlord, please don't put a price on my soul. And then he tells us that my burden is heavy, my dreams are beyond control. There's a definite suggestion of spiritual dissatisfaction here, as if the narrator is caught in a tussle with his own conscience. He appears to be pleading for salvation, but admits that, because of his uncontrollable dreams, this will be particularly difficult to achieve. The reference to a burden seems to mirror the fate of Christian, the protagonist of Pilgrim's Progress, who tries throughout the book to rid himself of the burden of sin. In Confessions, Book 10, Chapter 30, St. Augustine, who confesses to having led a rather hedonistic and sinful life when he was younger, he was a bit of a goer, that St. Augustine, when he was a young lad, he writes about the difficulties of leading a moral life when his dreams lead him back towards his old ways. Having stepped off the rock and roll treadmill with his temptations and distractions, that's still not St. Augustine, though you could say that St. Augustine did the same thing, you know, in his day. Dylan is trying to live such a life, but he fears that having given in to such enticements before, he will inevitably fall back into his old patterns of behaviour. The rather weird diction of, When that steamboat whistle blows, I'm going to give you all I have to give, and I do hope you receive it well, depending on the way that you feel that you live. Necessitates some complex piano figures as Dylan squeezes the words in. This adds a further level of uncertainty to the narrator's anxious protestations. Jacob Abbott, in his 1832 work Young Christian, describes the building and operation of a steamboat as a metaphor for life and death. In country pioneer Roy Acuff's song Steamboat Whistle Blues, the narrator laments not being able to hear the familiar Mississippi steamboat whistles as he is incarcerated in jail. This steamboat could be interpreted as the whistle that blows at the end of life, or the whistle that sets the ship of life in motion. The humble admonition of the last two tongue-twisting lines appears to be begging the landlord for approval. But who actually is this landlord? Many commentators assume that the narrator is addressing God, who, according to believers, is a kind of landlord for us in our earthly existence. The reference to selling souls, however, tends to suggest that he's preparing to enter into a Faustian pact with the devil. Lines in the next verse tend to rule out either of these options. Although they begin with another humble plea, "Dear landlord, please heed these words I speak," this is followed by, "I know you've suffered much, but in this you are not so unique." It is hard to conceive of either God or the devil having suffered much. Already we are beginning to get the impression that the narrator is actually addressing himself. We all seem to come back to this, don't we? This is reinforced by what follows. "All of us at times might work too hard, to have it, too fast or too much." This could be a description of the burnout that Dylan experienced after the grueling 1966 Going Electric tour. And who wouldn't be burnt out after that, really? He then shifts into a philosophical reflection. "Anyone can fill his life up with things he can see, but he just cannot touch." This echoes the famous lines from Matthew 16:26. "For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" These lines also conjure up the pitiful fate of Charles Foster Kane in Orson Welles' cinematic masterpiece Citizen Kane. Despite all the wealth and power he's achieved, Kane ends up living alone in this huge mansion, Xanadu, which is crammed with expensive material objects. Dylan's reflection here on the well-worn idea that material things do not bring spiritual fulfilment has great poignancy. But like Augustine, he seems to feel that it's very hard for him to resist such earthly delights. And like Kane, he is imprisoned by the trappings of the material world. In the third and final verse, the narrator presents the landlord as a kind of cosmic judge. "Please don't dismiss my case," he pleads. "I'm not about to argue. I'm not about to move to no other place." He's determined to stand firm on his principles, but he remains desperate for the landlord to accept him. Then, as in the previous verse, he universalizes his situation. "Now each of us has his own special gift, and you know this was meant to be true." And you can find an echo of this in Corinthians 7:7. "But each of us has his own special gift from God, one of one kind and one of another." And it said that when he was writing this album, he had a large Bible in his home in Woodstock, which was open quite a lot of the time, and he was consulting it quite a lot, as we see. There's a clear sense that, despite the humility of his address, he seems to regard the landlord as an equal. It may be that the narrative of the song consists of an allegorical conversation between the body and the soul. As with many early Christian homilies, it's the voice of the soul that we hear, begging the Creator not to put a price on him, and showing an awareness of the toll that excessive hedonistic living may place on the body. Well, I guess some of us have been through that, haven't we? I think Bob Dylan certainly had at this point in his life. The soul accepts that his body has suffered much through such self-abuse, but makes the excuse that many others are in the same position. Certainly seems that the narrator is engaged in a conflict between body and soul, and between materialism and spirituality. But although Dylan places the lyrics in the literary context of the Bible and related works, he does not offer any solutions to the ongoing paradox that he presents so eloquently. The remarkably equivocal final lines, with their direct address, "If you don't underestimate me, I won't underestimate you," indicate a striving to achieve a balance between body and soul, and thus between materialism and spirituality. This struggle is not only ongoing, but will continue to be so forever. For all of us, I guess, you know. Dear Landlord has never been a regular feature of Dylan's set lists, being played live only 6 times between 1992 and 2003. Most of the performances don't feature piano. At Sarasota, 9th of November 1993, it's extended to 7 minutes with an extended instrumental passage and some relatively aggressive vocals. In Visala, on 14th of March 2000, it's slower and more reflective, and thus closer to the original. The final live performance of the song at Hammersmith Apollo, 24th of November 2003, is marked by very distinctive guitar stylings by Freddie Coella. Most cover versions, like that of Fairport Convention, featuring the amazingly wonderful Sandy Denny on vocals and Joan Baez, are smooth and melodic, although covers by Joe Cocker and Janis Joplin do adopt a more forceful and soulful approach. I guess Joe Cocker and Janis Joplin tend to do that with everything, don't they? The deeply reflective "I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine" presents a considerable contrast. Whereas "Dear Landlord" expresses defiance and a determination to continue to struggle, here the narrator experiences a terrifying vision of spiritual desolation, which cannot be overturned. Yet the raw terror of the song is restrained by its warm and expansive melody, which is derived from the early 20th century protest ballad "Joe Hill," a song about a victimised union leader who is executed by the US authorities for stirring up workers in revolt. Joan Baez performed this song at the Woodstock Festival in 1969. It's perhaps ironic that Dylan chose to frame this mysterious song around a protest ballad about a martyred figure, when he himself had written songs about Hattie Carroll, Emmett Till, John Brown and Hollis Brown, all in their way martyrs, whether real or fictional. The first line of Dylan's song, "I dreamed I saw St. Augustine alive as you or me," is almost identical to the first line of Joe Hill, "I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night alive as you or me." In the narrator's dream, he pictures Augustine in a state of spiritual confusion, which has spilled over into outright panic. The saint is glimpsed tearing through these quarters in the utmost misery. The archaic sounding "tearing through" suggests that Augustine is not only going too quickly, but is destroying everything in his path, while the use of the equally old-fashioned "quarters" to indicate a living space places the whole scene in some mythical scenario in the distant past. Again, Dylan is mining the King James Bible. Exodus 13:7, when outlining the rules about what is kosher, states that "unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and there shall no leavened bread be seen with thee, neither shall there be leaven seen with thee in all thy quarters." And there's little doubt Dylan has actually been looking at this kind of language and putting it into his songs. In the narrator's vision, St. Augustine is said to have a blanket underneath his arm and a code of solid gold, and to be searching for the very souls whom already have been sold. And we've already seen, haven't we, looking at the last song, that Dylan does tend to identify with St. Augustine. This guy who, when he was young, kind of really went for it in terms of the equivalent of sex, drugs and rock and roll that was around in the 5th century and came to regret it later on to some extent, or he certainly had to deal with it. He appears to be engaged in an utterly futile task in his battle with the devil, who has already claimed the souls he was trying to save. The strange and perhaps impossible image of a coat of solid gold seems to suggest that he is, like the coat, impermeable to outside influences. The blanket underneath his arm may imply that he is planning to engage on a journey in search of those lost souls. Dylan is not depicting Augustine as a figure whose faith sustains him, but one who is caught up in utter confusion. The narrator's dream may well be a mirror of the state of his own soul, focusing on Augustine's failed attempt to bring salvation. Augustine, having failed to locate any souls to save, continues his increasingly desperate search with a vain appeal. "Arise, arise," he cried so loud, in a voice without restraint. He then appeals to all the gifted kings and queens to hear his sad complaint. His complaint is that no martyr is among ye now, whom you can call your own, so go on your way accordingly, and know you're not alone. "Arise, ye," and accordingly, all commonly used in the King James Bible. Augustine's search for a martyr, however, will be in vain. By this point in his career, many fans saw Dylan as a prophetic figure who could provide them with spiritual guidance. Dylan wasn't very happy about being treated like that. He saw himself as a songwriter rather than a preacher or anything like that, I guess. The song can be taken to indicate Dylan's own refusal, however, to martyr himself. But the narrator has internalized his feelings of guilt and is trying to discover a way of escaping from them. Augustine's ineffective quest may represent his own inner failure to come to terms with the conflict between material and spiritual worlds. In the final verse, he now dreams that he sees Augustine alive with fiery breath. Job 31-34 gives a graphic description of the monster Leviathan, a huge fire-breathing dragon. In the dream, the saintly Augustine has been transformed into a supernatural being. We are also told that "I dreamed I was amongst the ones who put him out to death." Again, Dylan's use of language sounds oddly archaic. The confession of responsibility for Augustine's martyrdom is somewhat ironic because Augustine had himself been searching for suitable martyrs. In real life, the saint died of natural causes. But here the figures of Augustine and Joe Hill are merged in the narrator's fevered imagination. The dream vision ends abruptly, leaving the narrator bereft. Dylan delivers one of his most memorable closing couplets. "I awoke in anger, so alone and terrified. I put my fingers against the glass and bowed my head and cried." His attempt to put his sinful life behind him has failed. At the Isle of Wight Festival in 1969, the song's performed for the only time with the band, who provide a rich musical setting with stirring backing vocals by Richard Manuel and Rick Danko. This gives a beguiling glimpse of what John Wesley Harding would have sounded like if the band had backed Dylan up in the studio. The song is later given a more upbeat arrangement for the Rolling Thunder tour, in which it is performed with Joan Baez. It is later revived with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers in 1986, when it reverts to a slower pace. As with Dear Landlord, in live performance it's extended to allow for instrumental flourishes. Performances on the Never Ending Tour are actually quite rare. At Cork on 16th of June 2011, it's given an impressively restrained and impeccably delivered outing. A 2016 recording by Eric Clapton treats the song with a surprisingly light touch, whereas Joan Baez is in her element, giving her all to this touching and emotive ballad. It's a song that really does suit her. Check out the album Any Day Now, released in 1968. That's Baez's entire album of Dylan's songs recorded in Nashville, and there's a great version of this song on there. I Pity the Poor Immigrant is another enigmatic lament which also deals with thorny moral issues. It has a distinctive flowing melody which is derived here from the traditional Scottish ballad Tramps and Hawkers, and it's delivered calmly and reflectively. As with Augustine, there's a considerable contrast between the darker elements of the text and the lugubrious way they are sung. But the moral panic of the previous song is replaced here by profound compassion. It begins fairly straightforwardly. "I pity the poor immigrant who wishes he would have stayed home, who uses all his power to do evil, but in the end is always left so alone," portraying a person who has been thoroughly corrupted. As Dylan puts it so graphically, "that man with whom with his fingers cheats and who lies with every breath, who passionately hates his life and likewise fears his death." Some commentators have interpreted the immigrant as a personification of white Americans, who are, of course, a nation of immigrants, with particular reference to the genocide that they inflicted on Native Americans. Others have seen the immigrant as a Don Corleone-type figure, a basically sympathetic character who turns to evil as a means of survival in the harsh rat race of American life. But there's little actual evidence in the text to support such assumptions. The final line recalls, "It's all right, Ma, I'm only bleeding," where Dylan lambasts those who think death's honesty won't fall upon them naturally, for whom life sometimes must get lonely. The immigrant is one such person. His life is a spiritual void. He's a liar and a cheat who's devoted himself to evil and who apparently lives in fear of divine judgment. In the second verse, Dylan makes the moral dimension of the song explicit by referring to the book of Leviticus, a section of the Old Testament in which laws for human conduct are dispensed. We're told that the immigrant's strength is spent in vain. This is a phrase that actually appears in Leviticus 26:20, "And your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits." We are also told that his heaven is like Ironsides, whose tears are like rain. And Leviticus 26:19 reads, "I will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass." The song continues, "Who eats but is not satisfied, who hears but does not see." And Leviticus 26:6 gives us, "Ye shall eat and not be satisfied." The final line of the verse, "He falls in love with wealth itself and turns his back on me," with its neat internal rhyme, maintains this moralistic biblical flavour. Dylan's Jewish heritage is clearly a very strong influence on these songs. His deliberate use of biblical terms and phrases throughout John Wesley Hardy has a similar effect to his use of quotations from and musical references to old folk and blues material that characterise much of his work. The use of such language grounds his texts in a particular tradition and adds resonance to them. It should not be assumed, however, that Dylan actually subscribes to the Old Testament morality of a book from the Bible, which is, you've got to say, extremely misogynistic and homophobic. He's attracted by the richly metaphorical prose of the King James Version, however, which give the songs a flavour of ancient wisdom. Again, very, very different to the kind of things he was writing. Well, very different to the Basement Tapes, never mind Blonde on Blonde. If the term immigrant refers to any particular socio-historical group in the song, it may be taken to refer to the Jews, who historically have nearly always been immigrants in other lands. Perhaps the immigrant is a Jewish person who, having been subjected to prejudice and persecution, has reacted by internalising all this to become a purveyor of evil himself, no longer capable of compassion towards others, with a heart of iron. That's a phrase that appears in a later Dylan song from Tempest, Long and Wasted Years as well. The use of a specifically Jewish text adds to the effect. And you may say that John Wesley Harding marks the first time that Dylan really looks in detail to his Jewish background. Despite his enumeration of the corruption of the immigrants, Dylan's performance of the song is highly compassionate. His sonorous delivery and his repeated use of the word pity demonstrate that he sympathises with the subject of the song. It seems that he also identifies himself closely with the figure he portrays here, who, like the protagonist of St. Augustine, is struggling but failing to overcome his sinful nature. There's no easy way out of his dilemma. In the final verse, we see the immigrant stuck in the moral quagmire he's created for himself, trampling through the mud. We hear that he becomes an exploitative conqueror who takes delight in dispensing pain to others. He fills his mouth with laughing and builds his town with blood. Perhaps the immigrant is one of the chosen people who, according to the Old Testament, is given free rein to ethnically cleanse the inhabitants of the promised land. The idea that John Wesley Harding represents some religious conversion is fairly dubious, I think, really. Most of all, Dylan appears to be interested in the language of the Bible, particularly the King James Bible. The ending of the song has some similarities to that of St. Augustine. While Augustine puts his fingers against the glass before breaking down, we are told that the immigrant's vision in the final end must shatter like the glass. Proper vision is impossible as the glass that the protagonists are looking through has been broken. And Dylan adds, "I pity the poor immigrant when his gladness comes to pass." Both gladness and comes to pass are frequently used in the King James Bible. Gladness is a 16th century term for joy, which in the biblical context also indicates achieving approval from and ultimately union with God. So the final lines are heavily ironic. The immigrant will never really achieve the gladness of salvation, but the narrator does not condemn him. In contrast to the harsh Old Testament morality of books like Leviticus, he merely pities him. This is another song which Dylan has performed relatively rarely. As with Augustine, it's given a soulful treatment at the Isle of Wight Festival before becoming a regular feature of the second leg of the Rolling Thunder Tour in 1976. However, this version, again with shared vocals by Baez, is surprisingly light and almost comical in flavour, as if Dylan is mocking the song's spiritual pretensions. After that, it is performed only once in the rehearsals for the MTV Unplugged Live album. It's been recorded by Joan Baez, Judy Collins, Planxty, and many others, usually in a similar arrangement to the original version. On John Wesley Harding, Dylan reflects on his own situation as he takes a step back from the explosion of poetry and creativity that characterised his early career. His pronounced use of biblical imagery and phrases mixed with various forms of archaic language grounds the songs in the language of morality. He's clearly fascinated by the wonderfully expressive tone of the translation, much of it derived from William Tyndale's 1525 version. The King James version is, along with the works of Shakespeare, the most influential text in the history of English literature. Its tone and its prose rhythms can be found to have parallels in the very many texts of English literature over the last four centuries, including explicitly religious texts like The Pilgrim's Progress, as well as works by agnostics like Thomas Hardy, whose novels often contained implied criticism of the bigotry and hypocrisy of the church. On this remarkable album, Dylan combines this unique amalgam of language with his usual influences of folk and blues material and his own colloquial interjections. He creates densely poetic and highly ambiguous songs that not only summarise where his own head was at in 1967, but also reflect rather soberly on personal morality during an era in which hedonistic excess was being promoted by rock musicians. Remember, this is 1967 and we've just had the Summer of Love. The songs appear to be a deliberate attempt to stand back from the psychedelic craziness that his early songs had actually done quite a lot to encourage, but this does not imply that Dylan had experienced any kind of religious conversion, as we said. That, of course, was to come much later. However, he now engages seriously for the first time with the themes of redemption and salvation, which will feature very strongly in his future work. Calm and quiet as the songs are, they indicate that he's setting himself on a path of religious and spiritual exploration, which will loom large for the rest of his career. Yes, well, I do hope you enjoyed that deep dive into some of the songs from John Wesley Harding. I'll be returning to other songs from that album at some future point. And that's about it for today. So don't forget to like and subscribe. And again, comments, any comments on this would be extremely appreciated. You can put them on YouTube. You can put them on my website, some of the Facebook groups that I'm in, that kind of thing. So see you next time. Bye. Is it rolling, Bob?
Rolling Bob?
Is it Rolling Bob?